The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades.
We have asked everyone in Wales to make changes in the way we live our lives.
Stay at home during this pandemic.
Welcome to Journos in Lockdown,
a podcast created by trainee broadcast journalists who are learning to report in a global pandemic.
As we've not been able to go out and meet journalists, we've decided to bring them to you and ask them what challenges coronavirus has brought them
and what the future of journalism might look like.
Hello, I'm Ben Pallett. At the beginning of June, I spoke to Channel 4's Home Affairs correspondent for Wales and Southwest England, Andy Davis. He's covered stories ranging from the phone hacking scandal, latter developments in the case of Stephen Lawrence's murder, and a Channel 4 News investigation into Cambridge Analytica, which we touch upon briefly in this interview. In recent months, he's provided some incredibly human and important reporting at the height of this crisis, including a stark and insightful long-form interview with a critical care consultant. I began by asking him how his career in journalism started.
Oh my goodness. Well, I didn't have any connections to journalism at all. And I was doing a postgrad at Nottingham University in international politics. And a bit different from when you're an undergraduate and fresh as fair, you're meeting everyone, you've got a bunch of friends that you've made very quickly. I suddenly found myself as a postgraduate in Nottingham, knowing absolutely no one, wandering around the fresh as fair with still actually very little idea of what I wanted to do with my life. And I wandered past the University Radio of Nottingham, the student radio station. And I got chatting to one of the guys there, and he said, oh, have you ever considered coming and doing some broadcasting with us? And I hadn't. That's how I got involved, not knowing what I wanted to do for so long. When I went into that student radio station and started ferreting around trying to find stories, I suddenly realized, yeah, that was the industry that I think I wanted to go into, and I loved it from that moment on. You know, working for Central TV and then eventually the BBC, it was a real moment just to suddenly work out this is what I wanted to do. When I was a trainee, one of the things I remember is Michael Burke coming to talk to us as trainees and saying to us all, you guys think you're going to be the editors of The World at One and the 6 o'clock news, but actually none of you know anything about finding a story. And we were all, you know, quite miffed when he left. And actually he was absolutely spot on. None of us did. And to actually go out and get a story. And that was a really good moment, actually, to tell us, go out, learn how to actually find a story. And I've always sort of remembered that moment as very instructive. And that's why it's great, you know, to people, if you're starting out in journalism, find a story, get on the phone, go and meet people, work out what's going on.
So, I mean, I think you're one of the few journalists who still actually goes out and speaks to people at the moment, albeit, you know, with a long boom mic stick. Why can't you just do it over Zoom? Why wouldn't this medium suffice?
I think with Zoom, it's a little bit difficult. There are delays. The sound quality isn't brilliant. And if you can do it safely face to face with at a 2 meter distance, then that's certainly our preferred method of doing it. And I think you just get to see people, that sort of that human proximity, I think really matters. And it's a comfort zone for all of us, actually, I think, to be sitting in front of someone and to be able to read their facial expressions, to be able to sense those moments when they're about to pause or you want to interject. And I think that it also, if you can find a contained environment to do an interview where you're not distracted. So I'm not distracted by what you've got in the background of your room, and the viewer's not distracted by that, looking at, oh, I wonder what books you've got there, Ben, at the back, or, you know, why is Andy sitting in his car? And if you can eliminate those distractions, then it makes for a much more sort of intimate and clearer interview, in my view. And the other thing is, if you can get into a situation where you've got that controlled environment, you're not being distracted, and I can get too easily distracted by noises off. So, you know, if the kids are in the house shouting, then I slightly lose my concentration, and I have to concentrate quite a lot in interviews, because you do want to listen to the answer as much as you can, as well as think of your next question. So I think that that's a reason why we've tried as much as possible to eliminate Zoom from the equation. And we did it with the consultant at the Royal Gwent Hospital, David Hepburn, and having him there for 30 minutes without any distractions, I think really allowed us to drill down into that whole interview without any interruptions and get the best out of that interview. And what I would say about him is that I can't recall having done an interview with anyone from any particular field who has spoken with such knowledge and candor, and being able to convey really sort of complex issues so clearly as he did. And that was a really, I think, an important moment in terms of public health information. And I think that's why what viewers have really appreciated during this is putting people who know what they're talking about on air and allowing them to inform the public about their area of specialism, about what's going on in the health service, about what's going on in intensive care. So we were very lucky to get an interviewee like him, because he sort of ticked all the boxes in terms of being honest about what was going on and conveying it in a very, very clear and understandable manner. It was one of those interviews that you get to the end and you think, how on earth am I going to edit that? Because we went through it and there were so many strong elements there, so many fascinating insights into the health service at the dealing with the peak of this outbreak. So the luxury for us was that we could go to our online team and say, listen, we've got an interview, we'll cut it down to 20 minutes. We think it'll get decent traction on YouTube. And it did. It got, you know, 1.25 million views on YouTube. So I'm really, really grateful that we had that opportunity to do that interview, not on Zoom. And Kevin Langdon, the cameraman, shot it beautifully. And you know, so it worked. It worked well.
Although news to an extent is obviously, you know, it's about facts and figures and objective reality, I've noticed you inject a lot of humanity into your questions. You do tend to ask people how they're feeling a lot. Why do you think that's an important question to ask?
That's a good question. Because I think if you ask that question, I think it opens up a new realm in the interview for them, and it allows them scope to talk about their emotions and how they're really feeling about being in a particular situation. And I think it's a question that whenever it's if you're asked that, if I asked you now, how are you feeling about life in, you know, lockdown, it'll make you think a little bit. You'll get more reflective. And I think that's when people become a little bit more interesting, a bit more personal, and they bring their own personal aspect to the experience rather than just a professional answer. So I suppose it just personalizes the interview and personalizes the story a bit more and then makes you a little bit more relatable to the viewer.
Has it been difficult to find people? I mean, you found some brilliant characters, you know, telling some really poignant stories. Has coronavirus made that task more of a challenge?
In some ways, you've got a captive audience because people can't say, right, I'm off to work, or I'm not going to be here this weekend. They're going to be at home, and in that sense, you know, if you want to speak to an expert, an academic, then you know you'll be able to get them. So on a very practical level, it's certainly given you a certain amount of access. But in terms of trying to find those characters who are experiencing, you know, the devastation of coronavirus or the economic impact, then it has been difficult because it's just such an emotive time and such a difficult time for people that you've just got to be so careful about how you approach them. And particularly one case of a woman whose father had died from coronavirus, and I had seen her talking a little bit about losing her dad on Twitter, and I didn't want to approach her directly because you wouldn't in those circumstances. So then I was trying to approach friends of hers indirectly to get their advice on the best way to speak to her. So it became a very sort of complicated process, and eventually turned out she did want to talk about her dad, and she felt that there were lessons for others, and so she wanted to get her message out. So, you know, eventually that interview materialized. But I think generally, Ben, that there's so many stories out there right now and so many people who do want to talk that actually there are plenty of opportunities to speak to people.
I mean, there's a big recession on the horizon, isn't there? Is that inevitable?
I think it is, isn't it? I think it is. And I think that's the sad, you know, the desperately sad thing is that, you know, when you look at all of the things that are happening this year, it's those communities that are already socially disadvantaged that are going to get hit the hardest, right? Hit the hardest during the flooding, hit the hardest during coronavirus and the health inequalities of that, hit the hardest when the recession comes. And that's where, you know, that this is just going to, that story is going to go on for a very long time. And that's where we're going to have a responsibility to keep covering the legacy of what's happened this year and the impact that it has on communities on our patch, and particularly in Wales, where there are those communities that are going to be hit very, very badly, I think.
So, I mean, the word unprecedented gets battered around quite a bit, but these are, you know, they are unsettling and tragic times. They are unprecedented times. Do you have an awareness that we're living through history and feel perhaps a greater sense of duty in reporting this crisis than maybe you would under normal circumstances?
Without question. I mean, it does feel like we're living through historic times. We all know we're living through historic times. So you do feel a massive sense of duty to create an accurate record of what we're all living through. And I think in terms of, you know, representing, I'm from Wales, I live in Wales, you know, there is a team of three of us here, Marcus Edwards, the producer, Di Baker, the cameraman, and myself, and we are firmly rooted in Wales. And if ever there was a time when you feel the responsibility to reflect the views and experiences of people in Wales to a wider UK audience, then it's now. And in fact, it was the same. I felt exactly the same through the floods. You know, the flooding, it was very plain to see that here you had socially disadvantaged communities in Rhondda Cynon Taf who were experiencing the most acute consequences of flooding. You know, there were people there without insurance who were really struggling, and I think much more so than other flooding stories that I've covered, where you go to a sort of fairly affluent riverside town in the Shires. These were people who had nothing to fall back on. And if ever there was a time for me to represent their voices, at not just so the politicians in Cardiff here, but politicians in Westminster here, then that was the time. So yes, a real sense of duty in terms of how we report this.
So, I mean, you've alluded to having to report more on Welsh issues, maybe perhaps more than usual. I'd say personally that Channel 4 was, for the most part, one of the better national broadcasters at representing the different approaches of the four nations. Has this crisis reinforced that obligation to report accurately on devolution?
That's very, very kind of you to say. We don't always get it right. And quite a lot of criticism over the years for not representing devolved politics in Wales. But yes, I think it's very plain to see that I can't remember a time when the Welsh government Welsh Parliament has been to the fore in the way that it is now at a time of sort of national crisis. I can't remember a time when the divergence in policy between Wales and England has been emphasised at a time when there's so much at stake. So it really is absolutely fundamental for us to represent the different policies around the UK. And that's really difficult at times for all sorts of reasons. But I think, you know, sometimes you can look at the media and, you know, ignorance in the media and blame the media and you know, justifiably so at times. But also I think you can point the finger at politicians sometimes and say, well, they are not helping the situation. You know, when the Prime Minister changed, was it over 3 weeks ago, I think, when he changed the stay-at-home slogan in England and did not make it clear in that broadcast that it was England-specific. Well, you know, goodness me, do we have a responsibility to our viewers and to our audience in Wales to make it clear that he was speaking in a predominantly England context there? So yes, there is a real responsibility to make sure that we reflect the different policies around the UK at the moment.
And do you think that might change things going forward, or will we just revert to the status quo?
I think it will change things going forward, because I think it's set a bit of a precedent, maybe, in terms of the way the information relationship between governments and journalists, devolved governments and journalists. I'd like to think it has, but we'll see. You know, we look at this crisis and think that it'll change quite a lot of things, but human nature being what it is, people fall back into lazy habits eventually. And so you'd like to think that some protocols have been established now that may endure.
You're listening to Journos in Lockdown.
I'd like to ask another question about how you think things might change going forward. So I had an interview your friend and colleague Krishna Guru Murphy did with the Dutch writer and historian Rutger Bregman. For those of you that don't know, he's the guy who, you know, went viral because he stood up and preached to the wealthy in Davos about the importance of paying their taxes. Anyway, he's just written a book called Humankind, where he explains quite persuasively that fundamentally, and in times of crisis especially, you know, we are at our core kind and collaborative, I was wondering to what extent you agree with this view and what you've reported that's shaped that opinion.
Yes, that's a fascinating question. And I've, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, I've covered a lot of criminal trials and have seen the most pure acts of selfishness that you can imagine. And it's quite easy sometimes to get a slightly distorted view when you go from one criminal trial to another about the way people act out of self-interest. And this year particularly, I think, has provided quite a nice counterbalance to that, because, you know, we've all seen those incredible acts of solidarity and kindness. And, you know, here in South Wales, you know, all those sort of volunteers who've been going around, you know, slightly unheralded, helping their communities and helping people on the doorstep. That we had to source some scrubs recently to go into intensive care. And that was quite a process to make sure that we weren't taking any necessary resources, but eventually found a group who had a whole surplus of scrubs because they'd been making them for the NHS. And that was a group of people in Penarth who just set up a network.
Well, scrub-a-dub-dub.
Scrub-a-dub-dub, yes. I mean, just fantastic. And, you know, again, you know, they hadn't gone and sought publicity. They just got on with it. And then I want to go back to the floods as well, because away from that sort of high octane lens of public scrutiny that comes with coronavirus, go back to the flooding. And I remember going into Pontypridd and the community centre there, and there were people who were every day making, you know, mums and their kids going and making lunch packs for people. There was this extraordinary collective spirit within those communities. And one woman who we interviewed, who was a teacher and was absolutely devastated at what had happened to her and had no insurance because the insurance cover had covered her for flood damage, but not for external flood damage, for internal flood damage if a boiler broke. And she was devastated. And she talked about someone just knocking on her door one day and saying, here's £80, I know you're struggling. And I bet you that person who handed her the £80 probably couldn't afford to do that. And she was overwhelmed by that act of generosity. And so I think from covering coronavirus, from covering the flooding, personally, I've seen so many incredible acts of solidarity. And we've tried to weave that into our reporting, but it has been, it's been fantastic to see. And yes, going back to your question, do I subscribe to that view that it's the survival of the friendliest, I think he put it, rather than survival of the fittest? Yes, I think I do.
Brilliant. So I wanted to ask a little bit about Cambridge Analytica. I know you're involved in an investigations piece last year, and I think Channel 4 won an award for it. What do you think the Cambridge Analytica story was so important and worth telling?
I mean, incredible work by our investigations unit at Channel 4 News, and that obviously followed the incredible work by Carol Cadwallader and The Observer. It was a real story for our times, and I think we felt that it was a story which felt totally relevant to our lives and our relationship with data, and dealing with how much personal data is now out there, is available. And our relationship between those companies that are accessing that data. And for a story to uncover that, you know, the amount of data that had been harvested by a company like that was extraordinary. And I think it was a real wake-up call for everyone to think about what they're doing on social media, what they're putting into their profiles, what can be shared, what can be accessed if you're friends with someone. It was an awakening, I think, about our relationship with big data companies. And that's why it was so important, because it affected all of us and it affected how we share our personal information and what value you put on your personal information, or what value others put on your personal information. And I think that's why it was so important. And it was important for democracy as well, whether democracy is transparent and whether elections are transparent and who are involved, which agents are involved behind the scenes when it comes to fair elections. So it tapped into so many sort of aspects of personal and public life. And it was fascinating to be involved with.
To kind of wrap up, I kind of wanted to know what you're most looking forward to when a sense of normality resumed.
Oh, is it terribly cliche to say, you know, the pub? I was thinking yesterday, just, you know, the sun was shining, and that
beer garden.
That sense of euphoria when you're with a group of friends on a weekend and sitting around with a pint, there's some, you know, a bit of music and catching up with people. I think that that would be a great moment. Being on the beach in Pembrokeshire, you know, all of those things that we wish for at the moment. So, and I suppose it's so exhausting for so many people, and so distressing and disastrous for so many different people what's going on at the moment. And to get to the other side of this after so much catastrophe, and the sort of the mental weight that carries for everyone right now, just to get that sense of relief that it's over, and we've been through the worst of it. And I think, you know, it's extraordinary to, you know, we're talking about lockdown easing and looking at pictures of people on beaches, but there are people dying every day still. And the gravity of the situation is always there. And it's sort of inescapable at the moment. And so I think when we finally get to the end of this, hopefully, just a break from this incessant story.
What an absolute gent. Thanks again to Andy for taking the time to speak to us, and thanks to you for taking the time to listen. Just a gentle reminder that you can follow us on Twitter, we're at Journos in Lockdown, and stay tuned for our next episode, where Neve Doyle will be speaking to Laura Garcia from Presspad.